Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, a weekly podcast that gives thoughtful people some perspective and insight on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of April 17th, 2014. This week, we're joined by our special guest, the coordinator of 350MA for the Better Futures Project, Mr. Malcolm Bliss. How are you doing, Malcolm?
Doing great. Thanks, Ted. Great to be here with you.
Well, I'm glad to have you with us. So, this week, yet another IPCC report rolled out, and I think it was fairly consequential, and I thought we ought to talk about it. Are you ready to do that, Malcolm?
Sounds great, yeah.
Okay. So, correct me if I say anything wrong, Malcolm, but this report was issued by the IPCC in mid-April. It's called Climate Change 2014, and it's directed at mitigation of climate change. Now, I find the IPCC stuff a confusing alphabet soup of all kinds of things. You can't really figure out what's going on. So for the benefit of people who may not follow it as closely as I do, let me just say the following thing. The IPCC is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. It was formulated 30 years or so ago, and it keeps putting out what are called assessment reports. In order to make up the assessment report about climate change, they have working groups. There are three main working groups. One studies the physical sciences, and they put out a report last September. There's a second working group that put out a report on impact, adaptation, and vulnerabilities. And keep in mind, these working groups are really volunteer scientists who read all of the scientific articles they can put their hands on and boil them all down into a report. And most recently, we've had Working Group 3 issue a report, the one we're going to talk about tonight, that has to do with mitigation. And just to keep everything confused, these three working group reports will be further synthesized into what's called a synthesis report that comes out in October of next year. So it's a very long and bureaucratic process, but there was a report that came out this week that talked about the mitigation of climate change. I'm assuming you saw that, Malcolm, didn't you?
I did, yeah, and it's very, very exciting. I think long-awaited, as you said, it's a long process to get these reports out. So everybody awaits them with great anticipation and, of course, dive in and now talk about it and see what does it mean and what does it mean for us?
Well, that if I can quote from the website of the IPCC, and I've got all these links we'll put up in the blog, Working Group 3, the contribution of Working Group 3 assesses the options for mitigating climate change and their underlying technological, economic, and institutional requirements. So that's a mouthful, but it's basically, this report is basically about how to reduce carbon and greenhouse gas emissions, and that's what the whole thing's about.
Yes.
So what I thought we'd do is, if you get a chance to read the PDF we put up, that's the executive summary. And in that executive summary, there are bullet summary paragraph headers. And so I thought we'd talk about a few of those and basically try and connect what's typically a very bureaucratic language to things that are happening in the real world. So one of the first points the report makes, Malcolm, is that effective mitigation, that is effective reduction of greenhouse gases, will not be achieved if individual agents advance their own interests independently. And what the heck does that mean? Can you explain that one to me?
Yes, and it's really kind of a classic test of ability to act collectively. If individuals, especially one example would be individual fossil fuel companies, act in their short-term best interest, that's not in the long-term best interest of anybody. For example, if a company like ExxonMobil says, hey, we're going to do everything we can to buy and sell more fossil fuels as fast as we can, you know, and just do that without regard to climate, you know, that's them working in their own near-term independent interest, and it doesn't serve the global interest. And similarly, I'd say individual nations have to be wary of acting their own near-term short interest. It's not the same thing as their long-term best interest or the interest of the planet as a whole.
I agree. I mean, that it's the individual interests range from individual people who want to drive a Hummer up to the president of China and the president of the United States who want to make sure their countries are protected at the expense of everyone else. So that's just one of the points that the report makes. Another one, and I think this is connected to what you just said, Malcolm, it says that the design of climate policy is influenced by how individuals and organizations perceive risks and uncertainties. And I think that, for example, goes straight to the question of Exxon, who is not perceiving any risk, and they put out a report last week that their intent to dig out all the fossil fuels they can. Did you see that one?
I did see that. It was quite shocking. And I think fuel to the fire to everybody who's working to take on mitigation policies, and the Working Group 3 put out a report saying, here's what we need to do to mitigate. I think ExxonMobil is just an actor, and they're playing in their interests as they do as a corporation. It's really up to the rest of the world to put some controls on that, and certainly a lot of people working on that. As it turns out, I was fortunate to be able to hear Jim Hansen's talk at MIT just 2 days ago on Tuesday.
Oh, he really? Also, good for you.
It was great. How great it is to be able to go down to MIT and hear Jim Hansen talk. And he also talked about this need to work together and avoid falling in the trap of kind of individual interests. It's a real global problem that we all need to work on together.
I tell you, I think you're right. There was another point the report made, and it's, again, these things are so couched in bureaucratic, caution, but it says climate policy may be informed by a consideration of a diverse array of risks and uncertainties, some of which are difficult to measure, notably events that are of low probability, but which would have significant impact if they occur. Well, what the heck does that mean? I think what they're hinting at is when the permafrost melts, we're all going to be cooked, right?
Yes. Well, the permafrost melts. I think of two high impact tipping points that we might anticipate, and they're very hard to predict. But one is as the permafrost melts, there could be a methane pulse, so that the result of permafrost melting may release a large amount of methane very quickly, and methane is a potent greenhouse gas which could rapidly accelerate the warming of the Earth. I think the other tipping point, which is very hard to predict, is the extent to which ice goes into the sea, which could accelerate sea level rise. So as ice shelves melt away, the glaciers, which are held in place by the ice shelves, could rapidly come into the sea, and it's very hard to predict when or if that will happen. So two very scary tipping point scenarios in the global warming crisis.
And I know that in the field of engineering, when you do an analysis of failures, you take into account the severity of the impact and you multiply it times the probability that it might actually happen. So even if something is relatively improbable, if it's seriously impactful, you have to think about it. And that's where that stuff fits in. The other interesting, or yet another interesting point that I saw was the fact that really struck me. It said, report said about half of the cumulative anthropogenic CO2 emissions between 1750 and 2010 have occurred in the last 40 years. Right, so I mean that means that half of the CO2 up there was put up there in most of our lifetimes. It just gives you a sense of how fast this problem is accelerating.
It is an accelerating emissions pace. And that 40 years is just one look at it. You can look at it in the 40-year span. Another thing that came out of the Working Group 3 report, the very recent IPCC Working Group 3 report, is that greenhouse gas emissions have grown by 2.2% annually since the year 2000, so the last 13, 14 years, they've grown by 2.2%. Prior to that, greenhouse gases grew at only 1.3% for the prior several decades. So that's a significant increase, acceleration in emission of greenhouse gases. Needless to say, that's going the wrong direction.
Right, and we sometimes think that we are suffering from the greenhouse gases that our parents put up or that Henry Ford emitted from his Model T and blah, blah. And that may be true, but quantitatively, we're putting up much more gas now, and the consequences over the next century are going to be that much worse. Another point in the report, and I'll just paraphrase it, it says that mitigation policy, and again, mitigation means reducing greenhouse gas emissions, mitigation policy could devalue fossil fuel assets and reduce revenues for fossil fuel exporters. That gives you a taste of what the Exxon guys are thinking about, right?
Yes. Yes, they have, I think, a right to be frightened if they're, well, it's them against the world in some ways. That's one way to look at it and say, look, we need to confront the climate crisis, and it means decelerating our use of fossil fuels. And I would say, to this point, mitigation policy could devalue fossil fuel assets. I'd say the threat of mitigation has already begun to devalue fossil fuels. And in fact, in the coal sector, this is already widely known and reported. So in 2013, Goldman Sachs reported the window to invest profitably in new coal extraction is closing due to environmental regulations and other factors. So coal is already in its sunset years. Even the market for coal in China is beginning to decline because everybody can see that coal is a bad thing, China and the U.S. Now, granted, other countries are continuing to burn, but with U.S. and China ramping down their coal, the end for coal is near, we can only hope, and you already see that reflected in the markets.
That's right, and this feeds into the whole question of divestment, that there are movements to divest portfolios, stock portfolios from fossil fuels, and I just note, I'll put up the link, that there are religious groups in Australia and the United States that have sent a letter to good Pope Francis asking him to back the fossil fuel divestment campaign. It'd be very interesting to see how the new Pope, who seems to have some level of environmental awareness, how he deals with that. Let's see.
Of course, it'd be great to hear him say that, and he'd join a growing chorus. It was just in the last week that Desmond Tutu issued his call for worldwide divestment, modeled after the South African divestment process of which he was a part. He's saying, let's do the same thing for fossil fuels. I was really moved by his call for divestment, and I think it will move a lot of others. I hope the Pope also joins the chorus.
There you go. Then so part of the reason that we're going through this is because even though these IPCC bullet points in the executive summary seem abstract, they do connect up to things that matter here in the United States and that we discuss often on this show and that are big issues for the climate movement. So let me just quote from one of the bullet points. It says, infrastructure developments and long-lived products that lock societies into greenhouse gas-intensive emissions pathways may be difficult or very costly to change, reinforcing the importance of early action for ambitious mitigation. Now that's a mouthful, Malcolm. Do you know what I was talking about?
Well, I could think of one project in particular. So long-lived projects, you know, when millions of dollars are sunk into a project, people want to get their money back by continuing to process or pump fossil fuel. The first one that comes to mind is Keystone XL Pipeline, and that's certainly one which is a major project. If built, that would pump over 800,000 barrels of highly carbon-intensive fuel per day. 800,000 barrels a day of highly intensive carbon fuel.
And on top of that, Malcolm, it would be planned to do that for 50 years. It's a long-term capital investment, is KXL, and it flies directly against this sort of advice from the IPCC. All right. I've got a link here that says that Jimmy Carter, God bless him, I saw him on Jon Stewart the other night, he signed on with a letter of other world leaders calling on President Obama to reject the Keystone XL pipeline, which we only hope happens, huh?
Yes, and you know what? I really believe. Well, John Kerry's from Massachusetts. He represented our state, and I think he knows. He knows. It's the right thing to reject Keystone XL. I believe President Obama knows it's the right thing. And I'm really glad that former President Jimmy Carter and so many other Nobel Prize winners are calling on them to do the right thing and reject Keystone XL. They need that support because there's so much pressure on them from vested interests of people who are those individual actors we talked about earlier. But with the support of Nobel laureates and so many others calling for the rejection of Keystone XL, we hope we'll give them the cover and the support they need to truly lead and speak the truth. So, you know, we got to wait and work to help them with the right decision.
And we will jump ahead. At the end of the show, we'll mention that on April 26th, there is yet another protest outside the White House against Keystone XL. We'll come back to that later on. So there's two more points I wanted to touch on here that are interesting. One of the reports, I'm sorry, one of the bullet items, and again, it's hard reading, but it says greenhouse gas emissions from energy supply can be reduced significantly by replacing current world average coal-fired power plants with modern, highly efficient natural gas power plants. Basically saying that natural gas is good, provided that natural gas is available and the fugitive emissions, that is the leaks, the fugitive emissions associated with extraction and supply are low or mitigated. So that was grabbed, but that bullet point was grabbed by some people to say that the scientists want us to use natural gas. I mean, did you, Malcolm, did you see much about that, or is that something, I don't know. I saw a bunch of different links here that basically say reject the idea that this is a call for using natural gas, and that the Obama administration is already got plans to put regulations in place to monitor the fugitive emissions, at least.
I think that's a big assumption and caveat they put in there. They did say, oh, assuming the fugitive emissions are managed. Well, there's no place where those fugitive emissions are managed at this point in time. And even if you could get through that knothole of fugitive emissions, and when we are right now experiencing huge losses of methane and natural gas to those fugitive emissions from the pad through the pipelines to the point of consumption, the fugitive emissions are large. And the other thing is, it's still a fossil fuel that it does emit carbon. So my thought is, much as other people have said, let's get beyond natural gas. You know, we got to go to the end game here. You know what? If you've got it in place already, plug up the fugitive emissions, but let's not have new emission, no new investment in natural gas. Let's go beyond that to the end state of clean energy.
That's right. And your points, I would plug again. Plug is the wrong word when you're talking about gas leaks, but there is the gas leak bill in front of the Massachusetts Senate to try and stop the leakage of natural gas in the pipeline infrastructure in Massachusetts. I saw in the paper this morning there was another home, I forget what Massachusetts town it was, but there was a gas leak and the house blew up. So these are real and present dangers. So then the one last thing I want to touch on is the favorite hobby horse that I like to ride around. It says, in some countries, tax-based policies specifically aimed at reducing greenhouse gas emissions have helped to weaken the link between greenhouse gas emissions and gross domestic product. And I think that is a call for a carbon tax. Do you read it that way, Malcolm?
Oh, I sure do. And the momentum toward carbon tax is growing. In fact, I mentioned I was at the Jim Hansen talk on Tuesday. He advocates very strongly for greenhouse gas. And you don't even have to go out on a limb to see how this works. British Columbia is a fantastic example of the effect that a carbon tax can have in reducing emissions and providing benefits for the economy as well. So, accelerating the transition to the green, clean energy future is a good thing for the economy and helps mitigate and reduce the amount of carbon emissions.
Absolutely. I put up a link to a Chris Mooney, I think he writes for Mother Jones, put up a link on the British Columbia experience with carbon tax on the MCAN Facebook page if anybody wants to read that. But British Columbia is a good example of a place where carbon tax is working. So there's lots more points in the report that we just don't have time to go through. I guess what I wanted to do is to take a moment and ask ourselves, what does it all mean here? We have the scientists giving us, pretty clear bullet point advice, even if it's in rather stilted language, right? What does it mean? Do you want to go first, Malcolm, or should I?
Here's what I have. I think it means we all have work to do. We have a lot of work to do, and we in Massachusetts have a special role to play, in my mind, and it's to lead as we have led on other issues of the past, going back in our history from marriage equality to health care, to abolition of slavery, even to the birth of our nation. We've got to lead again here. Most Americans, this is from just recently, the Yale Project on Climate Change Communication issued their latest report that says most Americans don't know there's a scientific consensus on the climate crisis. So, but if we in Massachusetts know and we listen to this podcast know, it's our job to go out and get others to understand and to take action and to be an example of leadership here in Massachusetts, an example that other states and the nation can follow.
I think you're close to the target there, Malcolm. My take on it is that the report is telling us that the world must act in concert. Right? They say you can't have individual actors. The nations of the world need to work together. They need to work together equitably to take care of less developed countries. We have to move soon. And if we do all those things, in fact, it's going to be cheaper to mitigate the greenhouse gas than to pay for the damages has. So from my perspective, there's an article in The Guardian I'll put up. What they said was that science has done its work. Right? If they're 99.9% certain, it doesn't matter if they get to 99.99% certain. Right? They've done their work. They've told us what the situation is, and it falls to people like us to take it in hand to carry that information forward. And I think that the other point I would make is that this report sort of juxtaposes, in my mind, the I don't know, the dark forces, the eye of Sauron, the eye of Exxon staring down. I mean, they put out a report the same day that this IPCC report came out, the same day basically saying they didn't think the governments of the world would get their act together and pass realistic greenhouse gas restrictions. And so Exxon felt that they were secure in their investments. I think they have a ton of money. They're committed to not taking action, and our job is to find some way to force them to, right?
I love the way the story of Sauron does end. In the end, the ring is destroyed, and we're set free, and we got great people working on this. It's so great to be talking about it, and encouraging everybody to dive into this and help with the work we got ahead of us.
So this whole thing with the United Nations, it doesn't end. This is a report. It's one of three preliminary reports that are putting together that it will be part of a larger report that will then inform something called the Conference of the Parties, a COP. And in fact, it'll be the next Conference of the Parties will be COP19, and it will be held in Paris in 2015. Right, Malcolm? Is that the date?
Yeah, the next one is in 2015, in fall 2015, in Paris.
And it's my understanding, at that big meeting where all the people get together, they're going to try again to sign a global treaty that limits greenhouse gas emissions. In other words, this would be another Kyoto-like treaty. And so what I wanted to do was to plant in people's heads the following chain of logic. Okay, you have this report that we've just talked about, which brings out dire consequences and makes very concrete recommendations about what has to do. That's going to be fed forward to the COP19 meeting in Paris. But when they all get to Paris, the United States and China, as the two biggest actors, basically have to look each other in the eye and come to an agreement. That's fine, except that in the United States, certain political elements are blocking action in a self-destructive way, but the U.S. is being blocked by its internal politics, and that's not going to change for at least another 5, 6, 7 years. Okay, so as activists, we have to say that this meeting is coming in Paris, but there's not going to be any help from Washington, D.C. And what it falls to us to do as local activists is to force local and state action. Because what we're building is the infrastructure, the methods, and the mechanisms that when Washington, D.C. finally wakes up, they're going to look around and say, you know, who's done this before? And we want Massachusetts and local areas across the country to be ready to go, right? Does that make sense to you, Malcolm?
I think that's right on. And this is a great example of where local communities around the world have to act and demand of national governments leadership. But if local communities don't demand the leadership, it's not going to happen. And change is coming so slowly, especially in Washington, D.C., where we can actually get some leadership on this, get concerted leadership from across the parties. We need to do it locally and work to find other local communities that share our interests. And I know what's happened in the local communities. We all got to work together, and that will provide the demands that we will make, and will make them stronger so that our national government will lead in the end.
I like it. Well, we said earlier that we were going to mention a political action down in Washington, D.C. that's coming later this month. So we'll put up a link to a 350MA project. It's called Reject and Protect. I guess it's going to be a week-long camp out by, I think it says Cowboys and Indians. I'm sure that's a self-applied description. I'm not that familiar with what's going on, but it's people from the western part of the United States camping in front of the White House to demand that the Keystone XL pipeline not be built. And the big day for crowds to arrive will be Saturday, April 26th. So if you're thinking about going down, you ought to seriously consider it, right?
Absolutely. It's going to be a really great moment to deliver the message that everybody can support. The message is no Keystone XL. Even what in our own history of our nation, having adversarial parties can join together and agree on this. No Keystone XL. And that's why they call the Cowboys and Indians Alliance. That's something that sounds like Hollywood, but it reflects the reality of ranchers say no Keystone XL. Indigenous people say no Keystone XL. That's a tent big enough for everybody to get under. No Keystone XL.
Hey, I like it. Well, I see by the clock on my computer at 29 minutes plus, so we're going to have to let our audience go. But I want to remind them that they can check out the links to most of the things we've discussed at the blog, massclimateaction.wordpress.com. You can leave a comment there, or you can send an email to comment@massclimateaction. You can go to the Facebook page, Facebook/massclimateaction. You can listen to the show there. Please like our page, share our program so that other people can hear about us. You can listen to us on Stitcher, which is a wonderful new application direct to your smartphone. You can find this show on iTunes by searching for Mass Climate Action in the podcast section. You can follow us on Twitter. MCAN tweets at Mass Climate. Malcolm, where does 350MA tweet?
For 350MA, it's at 350MASS, 350 mass.
350MASS, so there you go. So we'll close the way we always close by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it is our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the United States put a price on carbon. Thank you very much for being with us this week, Malcolm. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Ted. It's been a pleasure.
And thanks to everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you all next week. Bye-bye.
Thanks for being with us. And until next time, be green.
Very cool.